Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to mini episode 336 of Real Life Ghost Stories, and I have three spooky stories for you today. And the last story comes from January the 15th, 2024, and story number one comes from Billy. My sister is troubled. She tried to kill me several times. We shall call her Ness. I do have many other more colourful terms, but kids, listen. So the first time she tried was while I was still in utero. She tied a jump rope to the stair banisters and started screaming that she was hurt, so my mother would and did rush down to check on her, ultimately causing bleeding and bed rest. She almost lost me. The second and third time she tried to drown me twice, once in the tub when I was five and the second time in a pond by my grandmother's home. Ricky saved me the second time. The fourth time she tried to poison me with my love of smoothies. She took all, and I mean all, of the bottles of everything out of the medicine cabinet and made me a very sweet smoothie that I did drink. I woke up with a tube down my throat in the hospital. I was 8, and I was terrified. The fifth time she tried to hang me with a robe tie. I don't remember a lot of this one. I do remember waking up in the hospital. I was 10 at this time. This, I feel, is one of the reasons my parents split up. Right after leaving the hospital, they disagreed on how to deal with Ness's behaviour. Due to them not being able to agree on if she should be institutionalised for her benefit and my safety, she did not go away. My mother took us both to my grandmother's to live, which was the only good thing to come of it. This was when she started being brutal. She would pull out my thumbnails, both of which will never grow right, by sitting on my back and putting her foot on the hand of the day and using pliers. She would rip it out and tell me, "This wouldn't happen if you hadn't been born. It was better without you." I was beaten bloody with brushes, shoes, and the stupid giant wooden fork spoon decor people had in the 80s. Cornered and kicked sometimes until I was unconscious. It was my fault they split up. I just would not die. I did get smarter though. And a lot less trusting of everyone, including my parents, who this point I felt didn't care. I would love to say that the state stepped in, but we were not dealing with the state, we were dealing with the military, and I don't think the abuse was reported the way it would have been if we had have gone to civilian hospitals. So as a product of the 80s, who grew up a military brat, we were never really anywhere longer than 3 years. Because of this, whenever possible, my mother would pack us up and take us to my grandma's house as much as possible, because my grandmother had leukemia, and we never knew if or when we may have to say goodbye. Ness is 5 years and 6 months older than me. She wanted nothing to do with me in the slightest, unless it meant torment. She hated me. She really hated me. So back to Grammy's. At this time, there were no other kids in the area of my grandma's house. She lived in what was a rural area just outside of the San Rafael Desert. But I remember in great detail there being a little boy named Ricky, who would just show up and play with me. He was always there, and I loved him dearly. He helped me through a lot of the abuse from my older sister. He would help me hide, and to this day I still don't understand it, but I truly think he made me invisible so my sister wouldn't find me at times. Ness would storm in, ranting and screaming about what she was going to do to me, and he would, for lack of a better term, throw himself over me, and it was like she couldn't see me. I didn't understand it then, nor do I now, but I'm grateful for everything that he did for me. I can clearly remember telling my mother and my grandmother about Ricky. My mother blew it off as an imaginary friend, telling me I was stupid and silly. You're too old to have an imaginary friend. Though knowing what I know now, I'm not sure why she did this or made me feel bad about it. My grandmother, who was the most amazing and strong woman, would tell me my mother was full of shit and Ricky was as real as she or I, and would be there for me as long as I needed him, as he was for her. Ignore your mother, she can't understand. She's not special like us, Billy. Nothing more. It still makes me sad that I don't see him anymore. Fast forward to 2001. My grandmother lost her 21-year battle with cancer. I was married by this time and living in Georgia with my then husband and our 18-year-old daughter, Sienna Barbara, named after my grandmother. So she and I flew home for 2 weeks to help with everything and say goodbye. While helping to clean out her home, I found a black and white picture of twin babies, a boy and a girl. I asked my mom, "Who are these two little chubbers?" She said very flippantly, "My brother and I." Like I was just supposed to be privy to this knowledge. And I, very taken aback by this, stammered out with, "What the fuck are you smoking? Your brother is 4 years older than you, Mom. These are obviously twins." Then she tells me again, very flippantly, "Oh yeah, that's Ricky, my twin brother. He died when we were 5 from acute blastoma." Then she starts ranting about how I used to never shut up about him, so she thought that I knew. Chills. Anger. Annoyance. All at once. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. The little boy she told me wasn't real. The little boy she teased me about. This boy who saved my life as my sister tried to drown me. And she stood on the shore just staring dumbly at her while she did it. He was real. This boy was real. He was my uncle and he loved me. I had the last bit of contact with my uncle on this trip. Kind of. My little girl Sai Sai, while we were there, had made a friend who she was indeed playing with in the yard. She was only 18 months old, so her verbal skills were not the best yet. But she clearly said boy and me play when I asked her who she was talking to or babbling to. Then she ran off giggling and looking behind her as if in a game of tag. She had so much fun and it warmed my heart to see that he was there and that he loved my baby too. I've always felt things, known things. My grandmother was a clairvoyant who truly loved to tell strangers about things to get reactions. She told me I was gifted and my mother was not, and so she wouldn't understand. To this day, I remember Ricky, what his voice sounded like, how it felt when he was around. I was, and still am, very grateful to him. He helped a scared little girl cope with the brutality of an older sister who never wanted a sibling and parents who ignored the problem. I feel him at my grandmother's grave now, where he too is buried. Thank you, Uncle Ricky. I love you. Billy, I am so sorry that you had to go through that. It sounds absolutely horrendous. I think often when we talk about child abuse, we don't consider that it doesn't just have to be the adults in the situation that can be abusive, that children can be abusive too, to each other, like siblings can be abusive to younger siblings. And it's a really complex and horrible and difficult thing. And in my experience of situations like this, parents are often unable or reluctant to think clearly about the situation or make the right decision. They often are sort of in denial about how bad it is or how bad it can be. And just to say, like, as an aside, Billy, I hope that you got help. I hope that you had therapy or interventions or something. I hope that you have found a way to work through all of that torment and trauma. I really feel for you having read this, and I'm so glad that Ricky was there to look after you. I wonder if your mom just wasn't able to admit it at the time, just wasn't able to accept it at the time, and just dismissed it and kind of teased you about it rather than accepting, oh, this might actually be really happening here. And I am incredibly glad for your sake that your grandmother was on your side in all of this, that she recognized how difficult things were for you and recognized that your imaginary friend wasn't necessarily imaginary. And even if it was imaginary, it was very important to you. I'm glad that he was there for you in that time period. I really am. And story number two comes from Ellen. I am a midwife and I work in a hospital in Ireland. Before writing this email, I researched the age of the hospital online and discovered that the maternity unit officially opened on the site previously occupied by the city's asylum in 1933. These are a collection of stories I've been told by colleagues that have all taken place in our hospital. In our hospital, women with low-risk pregnancies who require induction of labour often go home after having the induction balloon inserted. They return if they believe their labour has started or for monitoring, and so the ward is empty at night unless someone comes in. Staff will often report walking past this ward to hear the patient buzzer going off, despite it being empty. The buzzers have been checked for faults but are apparently in perfect working order. Midwives working on this ward at night have reported seeing a woman dressed in old-style matron's uniform walking past the door at the bottom of the ward, which leads to the old conservatory. One night, a midwife, Maeve, got a call from a woman who wished to come back to the ward. We keep all the beds flat and raised to waist height for ease of moving, so she went down into the empty ward to lower a bed and raise the back up, ready for the patient. Maeve left the bay and walked up the corridor to fetch a jug of water for the patient. But when she came back into the bay, she noticed the bed was lying again flat and raised up to waist height. Thinking it was an electrical fault with the bed, she set the jug of water on the bedside table, swapped the bed with the one in the opposite space, and again set it up for the patient. When the patient arrived, Maeve walked her and her partner down the corridor into the bay, only to find the new bed back in the waist high flat position. Luckily, this patient progressed quickly and didn't have to stay in the ward for long. Our elective caesareans are performed in the downstairs theatre from 8 to 5 p.m. And outside of these hours, there are no patients or staff there. The theatres consist of many small rooms and lots of interlocking corridors with no windows. And there is a staircase that will take you directly into the busy delivery suite. Like most hospitals, we have colourful laminated signs for health promotion topics and hand washing on the walls and doors. One night shift, a midwife called Maria was sent from the delivery suite to the elective theatre to find a piece of equipment. When Maria tells this story, she reports feeling a sudden change of atmosphere as she got to the bottom of the staircase. A horrible, heavy feeling. When she turned the corner, she was confronted with a woman standing at the end of the longest corridor. The woman had long white hair and was wearing a white nightdress, standing in her bare feet. Her expression was morose. And Maria says she felt a wave of crushing sadness come over her as she made eye contact with the woman. She describes being able to see the wall signs directly behind the woman faintly, as if she were slightly opaque. Maria stood in shock for only a few seconds before turning on her heel and running back up the stairs to the delivery suite. She told her colleagues what happened, only to be met with other stories of encounters with the white woman. She was completely shaken for the rest of her shift. The equipment had to be sourced from a different ward that night. Many years ago, when the equipment was fairly new, delivery suite and theatres shared a printer. Because of the numerous stories shared among staff, most of the midwives wouldn't go to the theatres alone at night and would go in pairs to collect their paperwork after a birth. One particularly busy night, the delivery suite sister had instructed all the midwives to get their patients and babies moved to the postnatal wards as quickly as possible to make room for new labouring patients. A midwife called Joan decided not to wait on someone to be free to go to the printer with her and made her way down alone. When she got into the printer room, she found her documents sitting neatly in a pile at the edge of the table closest to the door, about 5 feet away from the printer. No one else went alone to the theatre printer that night. I love a good hospital story, let me tell you. I just find them so compelling. And I do find it really interesting that this hospital was once the site of the city's asylum. And as we know, through lack of understanding and lack of education and lack of funding, city asylums were generally not very pleasant places for patients. They were generally understaffed, badly treated, not really looked after in a way that they would be looked after in today's world. And it's definitely not the first time that we've explored stories where patient buzzers have gone off despite the rooms being empty. It's not the first time that we've explored stories where hospital mechanisms have moved or changed, like beds moving up and down, etc. I wonder if it's an easy way for entities gone by to communicate. And I think it is so compelling also when numerous members of staff see the same thing. I can't even imagine the fear that you would feel when you turn the corner at the bottom of those stairs and there is a woman standing at the end of the corridor staring at you. Long white hair, wearing a nightdress, standing in her bare feet looking real sad, and then all of a sudden you realise, I can see through her. I think I would drop dead on the spot, honestly. There'd be no way. I'd be like Maria. There'd be no way I'd be going back down to that delivery suite or that room on my own. Not a chance. And if I understand correctly, the implication seems to be that Maria wasn't aware that other people had experiences with this white woman, that she only realized that after she had this encounter and told everybody what had happened. So it's not like, it doesn't sound like she was sort of primed to see something like that, and because she was, I don't know, really tired from her shift, that her brain played tricks on her. It doesn't seem like that at all. I'm pretty sure I've told this story on the podcast before, so I apologise, but many moons ago when I was working in the psychiatric hospital, I was cleaning the female ward and I had pulled out all the beds, because the beds were like those metal beds that you could rise up and down, and I had pulled out all the beds to clean behind them and underneath them and clean the beds themselves. And I had pulled them all out and I left that section of the ward for about, it felt like about 3 seconds. It was probably about a minute. And when I came back in, all the beds had been moved. And when I tell you, my stomach sank to the floor. I was like, oh, dear God. But what I hadn't realized was that one of the patients had moved and was on the floor moving around the beds. I just couldn't actually see her. But for that brief moment, I thought I was witnessing paranormal activity happening right there in front of me.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
And story number 3 comes from Ryan. In October of 2021, at the height of COVID-19, I was looking for a little happiness. The lockdown had taken its toll on me and I needed something to look forward to. At the time, I was living on my own in a large 3-story house in rural Newfoundland in Canada. My soon-to-be ex-wife and I had purchased the home years before, and now I was alone in it with my 2 children, who were 8 and 5 at the time, staying with me 50% of the time. My girlfriend, Stephanie, lived in the capital city of St. John's, which was about 2 hours away, but would visit me regularly. Stephanie and I decided that it would be fun to do something spooky for Halloween, so we set out to find a Ouija board to use on or around the 31st. We were unsuccessful at all the retail shops, but found an old used board from the 70s for sale in an online flea market. Stephanie met with the seller and purchased the board with a plan to bring it out to my place on Halloween. October the 30th came, and we were enjoying the day, getting trick-or-treat items ready and watching horror films. As the night went on, we started to have a few drinks and thought it was a good idea to break out the Ouija board. We lit candles in the dining room and proceeded to play with the board. At first there wasn't much happening, but we continued to drink and joke about. But then the planchette started moving. First slowly, and then in big circular motions. Through a series of questions, we found out that we were speaking to a deceased resident of the town I lived in, called Elijah Stone. Elijah told us that he had died in the 60s. We were really engaged in the session when suddenly both of us were forced back from the planchette. It was as if someone pushed me backwards in the chest. The front legs of the chair I was sitting on came off the ground. Both of us were shaken up from this and took a few minutes to walk it off. Here is where we made our critical mistake. We did not say goodbye to the Ouija board. We left it and packed it away. You must always say goodbye to end a session. I cannot stress this enough. Days went by without incident. I went about my business, going to work, taking care of the kids, etc. Then one day, about 3 weeks after Halloween, I began hearing footsteps on the top floor of the house. At first, I passed it off as wind or creaking of the boards, but I came to realize that it was clearly footsteps I was hearing. Someone or something was in my house. The footsteps persisted into November and December and got progressively worse, to the point that it would stamp its feet up and down the hallway until I would lose my mind and scream at it to stop. Stephanie worked from my place one day and called me saying it sounded like someone was walking around upstairs. It was then that I told her what was going on. She didn't feel comfortable in that house ever again. One night in December, when I was alone talking to Stephanie over the phone, it stomped down the stairs to where I was sitting. I could feel its presence around me, and I have never felt so scared in my life. At 11 p.m. in the night, I packed up a bag of clothes and drove 2 hours to Stephanie's house just so I didn't have to stay on my own in my own place. Another morning in December, near Christmas, I awoke early to creaking in the attic directly above my head. This was 5 a.m. and something was walking above me. This went on through the Christmas holiday. In telling my co-workers about the goings-on, we nicknamed the ghost the Christmas Witch, which got a lot of laughs around the office. But I was far from jovial when I had to return home each night to that place. On the 23rd of December, my son came down from playing in his room and announced that there was a man on the top of the steps. He described him as old, wearing a green jacket and having a long beard. I immediately searched the upstairs rooms, turning the place upside down, but found no one. After getting through the holiday, I decided that I needed to do something to try and get this thing out. My friend and tattoo artist told me his mother has a special touch with these things, and she agreed to discuss the situation with me. The first attempt was to smudge the house using sage. Stephanie and I burned the sage bundle provided by my friend and we went through every room. When we reached my room, which is the access to the attic, I felt the presence of the Christmas witch behind me. It was angry. I could feel its anger all around me. The upstairs rooms were freezing. It followed me all over the upstairs room. It did not like what we were doing and it was letting me know. The smudging did nothing to stop it. It was relentless, banging and stomping its feet upstairs and up and down my staircase. After a week or so, I reached out to my friend's mother, who agreed to meet me at the house after I finished my workday. It was dark when she arrived. She came into the porch and immediately started talking with something or someone that I could not see. She asked its name and why they were here, and then she ascended the staircase briefly and came back down. I took her to the kitchen and offered her some tea, and she sat and told me the following. There is a ghost of a man residing in your house, in your attic, in fact. He died in the 1960s and he has no intention of leaving. You spoke to this man using a Ouija board, and he was able to cross over into your home through the portal you opened. He means you no physical harm, but he does not want to leave. You are lucky that he is the only thing which came through the portal, because it could have been much worse. Just as people are good and bad, so are spirits, and when you begin communicating with them, you open a door that anything can pass through without you knowing it until it's too late. You didn't close the door. The man's name is Elijah Stone. He wears a green army jacket and has a long beard. He thinks you are someone else who wronged him in life. He is confused about who you are, but he is not leaving this place willingly. As soon as he realized why I was here, he left and went to the attic. My blood ran cold as I realized this was the man who my son had seen at the top of the stairs. This was the man we were talking to through the Ouija board. How could this woman possibly know who he was and what his name was and describe him the same way as my son had? She asked me where the attic was and if I had a ladder. I went next door and borrowed my neighbor's extension ladder and brought it upstairs to the attic hatch. The air was cold in the attic and it was completely black. I used my phone's flashlight to look around as we both sat on the boards of the floor with our legs dangling out of the hatch in my closet. My friend's mother began talking to the ghost, trying to get it to leave. She informed me that it was in the far corner of the attic and it was refusing to talk with her. She asked it to knock once if it understood what she was asking. And sure as shit, a knock came from the darkness. She asked if it would leave on its own, and she asked it to knock once for yes and twice for no. Two knocks came from the darkness of the attic. I was in shock. I could not believe that this was happening, that it was real. My friend's mother told me that she was going to perform a type of ritual and asked that I go downstairs and shut the door behind me. I wanted to get the fuck out of there, so I had no problem agreeing to her request. I waited in the kitchen downstairs for what seemed like an eternity, when I finally heard her footsteps lightly coming down the stairs. She was whispering something I couldn't make out while she descended the staircase, stopping in front of the front door. All of a sudden, she held her hand up in front of her, opened the front door and moved to the side as if to get out of some unseen person's way. She closed the door firmly and walked into the kitchen when I was sitting, drinking a whiskey, white as a snowflake and visibly distraught. She told me that the man was gone. She had forced him to leave by placing chains and anchors in every direction of the house, filling it up so there was no room for the ghost to move, other than a narrow pathway for it to leave through. She then explained that for the next week or so, I must sit in the center of the house, on the floor, close my eyes and imagine throwing our huge chains from one end of the house to the other in all directions. I had to fill up every inch of the house with chains so that there was no way anything spiritual could enter. My friend's mother explained to me that Elijah Stone was not gone from the property. He wants to stay, and he will stay on the property, hoping to find another way into the house. This is why the chains are so important to maintain. As for the Ouija board, she told me not to burn it as I intended. She told me I must keep it with me, gift it to someone, but never discard of it or burn it. I still have it, and probably always will, so that no one ever uses it again. Not long after the events of the Christmas Witch, I sold the house. I never heard from Elijah Stone again, but I'm always worried he's going to come back and find me. Just to point out as well that in all the stories in today's episode, all the names have been changed, especially when they contain sensitive details. So just so you know, we're not here throwing out the names of people who have passed away in the house. So Ryan pointed out that Elijah was a real person who really passed away in that community. So he went for the name Elijah Stone rather than giving the real name, which might be distressing for somebody in the community who is related to this person who happened to hear the podcast. So just in case anybody is wondering, the names have been changed for privacy reasons. I just feel like for you, Ryan, like lockdown was really hard and COVID was really hard. I know it is still happening. I know people are still catching COVID. Indeed, I had COVID myself very recently. But I just think what an awful time to also be dealing with a Christmas witch in your house. I know the Christmas witch was actually the ghost of Elijah Stone, but still, I would have rathered none of these things during the height of COVID. And look, I'm not going to insult your intelligence by doing a PSA, but PSA, Ryan, you know the drill, okay? If you've been around listening to the podcast long enough, you know the drill. PSA, PSA, thank you very much. I would really hate to have something stomping around my house. I just feel like it would be so unnerving. At least if something's moving around, you can convince yourself, oh, I definitely put that there and I just forgot about it. Or, oh, somebody else in the house must have moved that thing. But somebody stomping around the house is pretty, it's pretty undeniable. And it really does give me the heebie-jeebies. And we all know, you know, people say that kids are more perceptible to these things. Like, it sounds like your son really did see him and came downstairs and was like, there's a man upstairs. Again, when that woman who was psychic came around and said, this is what he looks like, I think I would have been online straight away, adoption papers for my child. I'm like, you're too spooky. We're not doing this. Thank you. And you can also understand for this man, for this Elijah character, like, he comes back through the Ouija board, whatever way that works, I don't know. But he's there and he's like, who are you in my house? What is happening? Of course he's going to be stomping around angrily. Of course he's not going to want to leave. It's his place. It's his house. And in saying that, Ryan, I am glad for your sake and for Stephanie's sake and for the kids' sake. I'm glad you left and I'm glad he hasn't followed you. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Thank you to Billy, Ellen and Ryan for sending in your stories. Remember, the last story came from January the 15th, 2024. And if you would like to send in your story, you can do so by emailing it to reallifeghoststoriespodcast@gmail.com. You can also check out the website, reallifeghoststoriespodcast.com. And if you are desperate for some extra content, you can subscribe to the Patreon. That is patreon.com/reallifeghoststories, where for $5 a month or $2 a month, you get access to heaps of extra content, as well as every single main and mini episode completely ad-free. And on that note, I shall see you next time.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
Kayla Itzinas. I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.